everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2025, and you're listening to episode 451, which is a conversation about the newest book from Dr. Beth Allison Barr called Becoming the Pastor's Wife, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as a Woman's Path to Ministry. Today's guest is Ann Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People, and blogs about current events and theological trends on her Substack, Demotivations with Ann. Ann has written a book review of Becoming the Pastor's Wife, and her review is called Beth Allison Barr, Becoming the Leader She Knew She Could Be. You can read this article for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Ann, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, as I mentioned to you, we are going to be talking today in a spoiler-filled conversation about the newest book from Dr. Beth Allison Barr. And several years ago, Ann and I talked about her first book, which was called The Making of Biblical Womanhood, How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth. And that really made a big splash nationwide because she was an evangelical, very much critical for complementarianism, and also a member of the Southern Baptist Association with the church that she was attending at the time. I think she had since left that church. But so she's now back with a brand new book, as I noted. It's called Becoming the Pastor's Wife, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as a Woman's Path to Ministry, which is an extremely provocative title. Dr. Barr is also a professor at Baylor University in Texas. So what is Dr. Barr's premise of her new book about becoming the pastor's wife? And what is her main thesis in this book?
Yes, this is a pretty brisk read, and I would say fairly controversial given the state of evangelicalism in the U.S. at this point in time. The book is about is a historical look at whether there's any evidence for women performing ministerial and authoritative functions in the church up to the Reformation and then beyond. That's kind of a moment that she stops at for a while, and then but in the modern era as well. And then her conclusion is there is a lot of evidence of women acting as ministers, being ordained, and even functioning as bishops in some cases, and that it's historically anachronistic to look back in the past and say that women did not perform in pastor or priestly roles, and the Bible would say does not prohibit them from doing that, and so the modern church should re-examine the stance that prevents women from ordained ministry, give it a rethink, and you know, it's not take the history for what it is and the Bible for what it is, and sort of join the modern era, as it were, and allow women full equality in the church in ministerial roles.
That's very interesting that she's kind of taking that look at things through the historical lens that you mentioned, because that's her expertise is, I guess, history. And so specifically, since that is her expertise and her degree, where in history does Barr claim that she has found this evidence of what's called, she says in the book, independent leadership? And where is she saying historically does it show women in more of a pastoral type of minister type of a role?
Well, so she begins right back towards the beginning there. She references sort of briefly New Testament era women such as Phoebe and Priscilla and Junia, which she mentions in her other book as well. And that's a big argument about the degree to which women in the New Testament exercised leadership, and there's been lots and lots written. I would just say her analysis of Junia in particular, I think, is very specious. I'm not exactly sure if that's the word I want, but she puts a lot of weight on those three women, Junia in particular, and there isn't really good consensus or scholarship on whether Junia was a person who we would term ordained or understand it in that way. And I think most scholars would say that there's just not enough evidence for that. But she kind of takes that as read, that of course Junia was an apostle alongside the apostles. But she moves quickly from the Bible to her first section is about, she spends time going to the Priscilla catacombs in Rome and looking at this one chapel that has figures of women, a lot of women, but in particular a woman who appears to be in liturgical garb, and she's at three different sort of scenes in her life. And the question is, what are those scenes? The tour guide that went with her through the catacomb said it was a woman, you know, on the day of her marriage, and then as she became a mother, and then her death going into heaven is kind of the traditional view of that person. But there are some scholars who believe that that figure, it's sort of a fresco, is a woman who's being ordained or being consecrated by a bishop, and then is exercising authority or leadership, and then is maybe part of the order of widows, and empowered to protect or care for neglected infants. And so she spends a good amount of time on this figure and what it might portend. And then she kind of pulls together different sources from the very early church about whether or not women, what kind of functions they might have had. She believes that the order of widows in particular would have been, eventually they were listed amongst clergy, that they probably exercised a great deal of authority in the church, is kind of where she lands on that. And all through this, she weaves through her own experience, experience of being a pastor's wife. But she moves forward into the Middle Ages to some very powerful figures, Milburga in particular, who was the abbess of a double monastery, meaning both monks and nuns, who is depicted sometimes with a crozier, which is the bishop's staff. And she mentions some other women as well, but she really spends a lot of time on Milburga. And then she teases out the period after the Reformation, where the monasteries and convents were shuttered, priests began to marry, and the pastor's wife kind of emerges in the rubble, where women had positions. If an unmarried woman joined herself to a convent, for example, she could rise up in the ranks and become very powerful in terms of church hierarchy and influence. And that kind of disintegrated at the Reformation and the aftermath. And so Protestants then did not want to, you know, become nuns. And so what were women to do? And they weren't prepared, as time went on, to ordain women. The only way to gain authority in the church was to get married to a pastor and take up the role, sort of an unordained ecclesiastical role or function within the church, unpaid, of a pastoral care, ministry, sometimes even preaching and teaching, alongside a husband. And so she has a lot of instances of that that are kind of woven through, of women who wanted to be ordained but were turned away, pastors' wives who functioned basically as pastors in different contexts. So she covers an enormous amount of territory from the very early church all the way up to the present day. And she weaves it together quite artfully, I would say, with her own story, and tries to make a case that we got it wrong.
So this is interesting that this particular book is a follow-up to her first one, which listeners can go. We will link in the show notes where this article is on the quip.org website. You can listen to the podcast that Anne and I did then and also read the review of her first book. But, you know, it caused a lot of waves at the time. Has this particular book been received as, I guess, widely as the first one was?
I have seen a few reviews in some places, but it doesn't seem to have made quite the splash. I think because maybe, I don't know if we're even more polarized than we were a few years ago, or if people have kind of settled out into different ideological spaces. It is controversial because the Southern Baptist Convention did just meet, I think, last week or the week before, and it's a continual conversation within the Southern Baptist Convention about the place of women in the church. And so I think the book I saw in different news articles was referenced here and there, but I haven't heard a lot of people reading it or talking about it in the same way that I did the previous book. There is a very glowing review in Christianity Today. And apart from that, I haven't come across too many different places. I don't know that it's making quite the splash. I think people probably expected her to write a book like this. And those that are on her side are, you know, excited about it. And those who aren't are probably not paying attention.
So as of this week, we're in our final days before our fiscal year end, when we ask you guys that listen to this podcast and read our articles twice a year, would you consider partnering with the Christian Research Journal and the Christian Research Institute to continue to bring you more of its content? But I guess I could say things like I normally do, but I just want to read to you some of the comments that we've received over the years on Apple Podcasts that's talking about this particular podcast in particular and why you would partner with us so that we can continue to bring this podcast not only to you, but to Christians worldwide. I will quote from this one review that says, quote, "Topics are relevant, insightful, and sometimes unusual, but always informative. I enjoy the wide spectrum of subjects ranging from movie reviews to today's controversial subjects. I appreciate the biblical worldview that is always front and center." And so another one says this, "I love the variety of topics and examining current culture through Christian worldview. The question and answer format is great, and the writers and the guests are very knowledgeable. I also appreciate that they get right to the point and don't waste the first 5 to 15 minutes doing useless chit-chat and inside humor, as so many podcasts do. And if you're like me and you're a regular podcast listener, sometimes that happens when you listen to podcasts. I am 20 minutes in and they haven't even talked about the topic for which I tuned in for. But we want to get right to the point. And the reason why we do the question and answer is because we're featuring these articles written by these writers and they have so much expertise and I want you to hear from them. So that's why I enjoy asking them questions. Also, I'm a question asker and so I want to find out more about their topic that they wrote about. And so thank you for listening faithfully to this podcast. If you subscribe, there's so much content. We hope that you will let other people know about it. And if you are willing to consider it, we'd ask that you would give a partnering gift, because before, this was completely a subscription magazine for more than 40 years. And so now we are totally free to anybody online 24/7. They can listen to this podcast. They can read all the articles without a paywall. And I know so many organizations and other news outlets or magazines that are feature magazines, they have a paywall and you get one free article a month. Well, that's not true. You get all of our content, thousands of articles free all the time, just available to you and any Christian worldwide. So thank you for listening. We appreciate the ways you so practically partner with us by sharing our episodes, telling a friend, and also just downloading them every week. We're just so thankful for that. And now back to my conversation with Anne Kennedy. Well, one of the things she keeps talking about in this particular book is independent leadership, women and independent leadership. What is this a term that she's coined? And if so, what does she exactly mean by that phrase, independent leadership?
I found this phrase so interesting and I kind of got hung up on it. It appears, I think, 11 times in the book, although she uses the word leadership a lot. And she says that refusing to see the position that women held in the church, in ordained or in authoritative functions, is anachronistic. If you look back at history and you don't see that, or you see no evidence of it, you're really reading your own perspective back into history. I would say that I found the term independent leadership to be an anachronistic term. I don't see how you can use that and look back at history or the Bible. It just seems like a very modern idea that doesn't really correspond well with what I would see in history or in the Bible. She would count a woman to be an independent leader, a person who was unmarried, who did not have to rely on her husband's authority to do any work in the church. There's a few cases where women were married to pastors, but carried on and did their own thing and, you know, maybe traveled around and preached and without the blessing of a husband, or, you know, it didn't seem to be a problem. So she's looking through up until the Reformation, unmarried women who engaged in the life of the church authoritatively, maybe Hildegard of Bingen, Priscilla was married, but so that it kind of immediately breaks down. I would never count Priscilla, the wife of Aquila, to be an independent leader in the church. That she had influence over is clear in the text. She and Aquila take Apollos aside and instruct him in the way, and they kind of correct him. And she's obviously a very important person in early church history. And I think doubtless the order of widows probably did grow into an early sort of monasticism. And the church is replete with women whose names we know, who wrote, who organized things, who spoke authoritatively and performed, did acts of ministry. I don't know if that's not probably a very elegant way of saying it, but obviously women were an essential part of the life of the church, and they did important and impressive things along the way. So it's interesting to me that she would use this term, independent leadership, for an era in which independence was probably not understood in the way that we understand it now. And then bring it into the modern era, looking for women who act and work in the church without the authority and blessing of somebody like a husband. That's what she's looking for. So if you are a pastor's wife and you lead a Bible study and do the women's ministry, maybe even you preach a sermon, you wouldn't count as an independent leader. But Melburga in the Middle Ages, who was an abbess and was doubtless under the authority of a bishop, would count as an independent leader. So it seems very, to me, very arbitrary term. I struggled with it a lot. I don't think it's a good measure of the sort of world in which men and women live together, the church. And I would love for her to untangle that a little bit more and say why she chose that term and what she means by it and why it applies, you know, to unmarried women who are under the authority of a pastor or a bishop, but not to a married woman. And what also is so wrong with being under somebody else's authority? She kind of takes it as a given that that's a negative, and that women being under the authority of men is bad for them, and that they have the right to exercise or do work in the church on their own terms, is that that's a given. That's a good obviously. And I don't think she makes the case that it is. I think she still has a lot of work to do on that score.
That is a fascinating term to me because just in general, irregardless of gender, man or woman, the idea of independent leadership in the church in general doesn't seem like what the church is teaching in the epistles. I mean, you know, there's people with different authority, even men, but it's not you're independent from the rest of the church, or I'm not sure what she really means by that. So it is a curious term. So what does she think is the issue for women in the church? And what would she say where it went wrong for them in terms of now she sees, like, there was this medieval period where women were these, you know, almost the point of bishop, or that's what she's arguing. And now women are just exercising what gifts they can in a marriage, which she doesn't think is really what the church women should be called to in terms of leadership in the church.
Yeah, I found this to be the case in the Making of Biblical Womanhood as well. She says she's not looking in the past with, you know, rose-colored glasses. That she doesn't seem some utopic vision in the past that got wrecked. She wouldn't say that the past was really wonderful and everything we have now is really bad. But the way that she frames the narrative always leaves me thinking that that's what she's thinking. That it seems as if she thinks there was this sort of movement towards full equality for men and women. And again, I would use the word equality in a modern sense, the way that people use it now, which is that there should be no barrier for women doing any particular work, that men and women are essentially the same, except for some parts of biology, and that there shouldn't be any, especially in the church and the home, a woman shouldn't submit to her husband. They should both mutually submit to each other in all things. So you don't hold different texts and admonitions and intention with each other and try to harmonize them or live out the mystery of marriage. You just sort of make this clear, men are completely equal to women in everything all the time. It seems as though she thinks that that was something that was definitely going to happen, but then the Reformation came, and in the sort of unraveling of different parts of social life that happened as a result of the Reformation, there could have been, again, a sense of greater equality, but then it didn't happen. It didn't work out, and women were pushed towards marriage. And if they wanted to work and live in the church, and if they wanted to work and exercise authority in the church, even though maybe nobody did this in a nefarious way, they didn't try to be bad. It just happened that they were more and more curtailed in what they could do, and they had to depend on the authority of the man they'd married to be able to do work. And so she has a chapter, there's different points at which she would say things kind of maybe unraveled. So one would be during the era of Milburga, that who could celebrate the Eucharist, she says, was more a localized situation. So maybe Milburga would have celebrated the Eucharist in her local context. She might not have been able to travel around to do that, but they didn't have the same idea of ordination in her day as they do now in the Catholic Church. And so as things became more about biology, she says, the idea of the Eucharist changed and ordination changed. And so women were barred from celebrating the Eucharist. And similarly, there had been a lot of women at the time of the Reformation who, you know, Catholic priests were not as celibate as they should have been. There were a lot of people with mistresses in the church. And after the Reformation, many of those priests married those women. But it was still a sort of a second class thing. And that didn't help in the sort of equalizing force that women were hoping to have as life went on. So she picks out these kind of moments in church history where it seems like she believed it would have gone one way and then it didn't. And then more in more recent times with the SBC, it looked like women were going to achieve full equality in the church. There were women being ordained as pastors. And then in the 90s, there was this conservative resurgence led by Al Mohr, and they pushed back hard and they managed to debar women from being ordained. And again, now maybe there could have been another cusp of this, but lately, I think in 2023, Saddleback was removed because they have women on staff in pastoral roles. So in each case, it seems like, oh, maybe women are going to get there, but then men usually come along and push them out. And so they just never get to have the full equal lives that they deserve and that they have apparently always had.
That's really interesting. And I think that became kind of a lightning rod thing when Rick Warren's Church of Saddleback had to answer to the full Southern Baptist Convention as to whether they in fact had women on staff as pastors, I think.
Yes, I mean, I remember I watched it go down. I'm always confused by Southern Baptist terminology. So I think there's something called the law amendment, and I think that has to do with women's ordination. And I think it never quite passes all the way. I'm not quite sure, but the removal of Saddleback was a big deal, and I don't think people expected that it would happen. And it still seems that in many, well, I don't know if it's many, but some Southern Baptist churches, there are women who exercise ordained pastoral functions, and it's always a controversy about whether or not they should be allowed to do that. And there does seem to be this very unsettled back and forth about the roles of women in the church and in the home.
So how does she communicate basically the role of a pastor's wife now in contemporary times? I mean, one of the people that she points to, I think, with, I don't know if I would say disdain, but just total disagreement of what she's saying and how she's perceived is a woman by the name of Dorothy Patterson, who is the wife of a Southern Baptist, former big Southern Baptist leader. So what does she say about Dorothy Patterson?
Well, this was very exciting. I felt like the sort of pure historian slipped away, and this became very personal for Barr. As you read the book, it does get very exciting. She really, really doesn't like Dorothy Patterson. And it seems that Dorothy Patterson had an enormous amount of influence over women in the 80s and 90s, over pastors' wives, that she developed a course, a seminary course for, you know, wives of young men who were in seminary to become ordained. The women could take courses, and they would be taught how to be good pastors' wives. And so it seems that Dorothy Patterson and others like her really shaped the expectations that modern women live under in their life as the pastor's wife. It is a sort of a formal function. It's a formal place that you have. It does carry authority, authority that's derived from the pastor, the husband. And so she was very forceful and clear in her expectations of women in the 80s and 90s. And it included things like keeping a very tidy and beautiful house. She gave very particular instructions about decorating and what kind of food to keep in the fridge and being able to be hospitable on a dime. She had something called a company box, I think, that she encouraged women to keep things in a basket or some way that you could easily pull a meal together. You could make a coffee. You could invite people into your home, and it would be ordered and peaceful, and the husband wouldn't be looking for his socks or his shirt on Sunday morning. He could really depend on his wife to care for him as he ministered to the church. And then So she set a high bar of expectations that I think, according to Barr, many women struggled under and felt they were inadequate for. And some women didn't want to be in that role. They didn't want to sort of be the smiling wife in the front pew. They didn't want to play the piano. They didn't want to make the bulletin, but they had to because she kind of institutionalized that function. And I am a pastor's wife, so I certainly know the struggle. I didn't know that maybe the source of a lot of that was Dorothy Patterson, but I thought it was interesting that Barr obviously has a lot of emotion around this particular name and this person, and isn't able to write quite dispassionately about her influence in the church. I have heard other people talk about Dorothy Patterson. I think that many people found her a beloved figure and didn't view her with the same animosity or, disappointment at having a yoke placed on their shoulders to carry along even against their will.
That's very interesting. Do you think that Dr. Barr makes a theological and biblical case for the ordination of women? I feel like this topic just keeps coming up over and over, maybe with just a different twist every few years. And so does she do that? I think when we talked about I really want to point people to her former book, because as a historian, she does appeal to certain theological arguments that have already been answered many times. So do you think in this particular book that she went at it again and she was more successful in making that theological case?
I didn't find much theology in this book. I did think her discussion of the changing views of ordination and the Eucharist were interesting. I've read about those in other places, though, and so I'm not quite, I doubt her particular view of how that went down. Obviously, she is referring to a period in history that's well documented, and she sort of gets up close to it, but she doesn't really get to the heart of those issues, which really did affect the church and the way we view sin and confession. And there was some deep and profound shifts in the view of the human person in relation to God that did happen through the Middle Ages that are really crucial for understanding where we are today. And she kind of refers to them, but she doesn't deal with them in a way that I found satisfactory. And I don't quite, I mean, I didn't follow up every single one of her footnotes. I question her reliance on some certain scholars who, especially in the terms of the Priscilla Catacombs, her assumption about how men and women would have lived in the ancient past, I don't buy. I don't think she establishes even historically a historical case for the ordination of women. And she absolutely doesn't do it on a theological level. She really doesn't. She just assumes that that's what Jesus and Paul would have wanted and moves on without showing how that idea would have come about, where it comes from in the scriptures, what it does theologically to the church, to our view of God, to the person, to the sacraments. She doesn't go there, really. She assumes that the case has been made. And I find that disappointing because the last century has been tumultuous in terms of men's relationships to women. In the church and in the home, and there's so many different factors that have absolutely shifted and changed the way that we function in the world and our assumptions about good and evil and about God and people. And I do think we need to think about this. One thing, for example, I think in the modern era, and this colors her work, there's no status for women as women that appears to be meaningful. I think one reason why Barr just wouldn't be able to fathom a world in which women couldn't be ordained is because in our world, to be ordained is one of the most important functions that there is in the church, or the most important. And I don't think that that's how it was viewed in ancient times. I don't think women felt less than because they weren't ordained. I don't think that women had the same expectations of life that women do today. And that's worth investigating. But Barr doesn't investigate that. So I found this, the lack of a theological case being made, to be perplexing. And I found her historical work to be also similarly not connecting the dots, not really showing me how she got from A to B to C to today.
So as this debate continues within evangelical spheres, does she actually deal theologically or historically even with any objections to those, for example, in evangelical spaces or other spaces for that matter, who believe in complementarianism and that women shouldn't be ordained, which, by the way, is not just the purview of Protestants. Other Christians who are not Protestant don't ordain women either. And so does she satisfactorily deal with it in a way that's persuasive?
Not really. She doesn't really take it up. She doesn't say why women should be ordained, and then she doesn't deal with those arguments of people who say that they shouldn't. She does go into the question of abuse a bit. I think her assumption is that women without authority in the church are more readily abused, and so by men. And so it's actually very dangerous for women not to be able to be in the upper echelons of power, if that's the way you want to view it. And so there is kind of a moral sense that she implies that women should be should be pastors, if only to keep abuse-free churches. But that's not really a theological argument. And she does not, at least she didn't in the last book and she didn't in this one, really address and answer the objections that most Christians have for the ordination of women, most of which come from scripture, but some are sort of purely theological or sacramental. And she doesn't get into it. So I don't know, you know, it's kind of hard to argue back when you aren't dealing with anything precise or meaningful.
So because the title of her book suggests that the church today is not operating where women's gifts are fully used in the full sense of the word with the authority that they should have, what kind of church does Barr think would be best?
Well, I think she would like a purely egalitarian church where women are able to be bishops, if that's the kind of church they're in. And that she's SBC, so there are no bishops, but they should be probably senior teaching pastor. And it would be a very good thing to have a staff that's made up almost entirely of women. And, you know, men and women can get along. There can be male pastors as well. I would imagine she would be for that. But there just shouldn't be any limit on the work that women are invited to in the church for her. And I think she would say that this would make the church more representative of what Jesus was like, and it would be a protection against abuse, and it would just be good all around, which that's at least kind of the vision that she paints. And if you want to be a pastor's wife, that's really great, but you shouldn't have to live up to anybody else's expectations while you're doing that. And I think in her perfect world, Dorothy Patterson would not have written any books or have any influence in the church at all.
Did she address the fact at all that the Bible does emphasize the biological, at a very basic level, the binary, you know, creation that God has for man and woman? Or does she just doesn't really see any reason for that beyond just pure procreation?
Yeah, she doesn't really get into it. She doesn't deal with anything like Ephesians 5. She doesn't really address the scriptures much. She does talk about Peter's wife and how she just isn't mentioned in the scripture. And so we can only wonder about that. But she really doesn't get into the differences between men and women and what that portends, what it means for life in the church. And she also doesn't really go into the question of masculinity in a way that I found satisfying, or femininity, which are big hot topics today. And I think fascinate a lot of people, and most people want to know more about those things, not less. But she kind of, it doesn't seem to have much bearing on her argument. Really, she leans very heavily on this question of independence and of leadership, both of which are categories that I don't think are very suitable for understanding the scripture or the church through history.
So she is still, I assume, a Southern Baptist, even though she has perhaps many critiques of it. So there's an organization called the Baptist Women in Ministry. And so what is that organization, and does it align with what she believes at all?
The Baptist Women in Ministry organization had an event at the same time as the SBC convention a couple of weeks ago. It's an organization that is trying to help women gain equality in the church. So their website says, imagine a gender equal Baptist world. And so they help women through the process to become pastors, basically. And Barr gave a speech at their event, was it last week or the week before, and made, I think, the case that was in her book about why it is essential for women to be in leadership in the church. And so it's interesting to me that there's this group out there. I don't think it's necessarily associated with the SBC, but they are trying to help women get into churches and become pastors and preachers and teachers and help fund them and find them the opportunities that they desire. They met at a United Methodist church, though, next to the convention hall.
That is very interesting. Well, I would like to point our listeners once again to Anne's article and her review of this book. And on a much lighter note, Anne, we just recently celebrated in June, because the U.S. has holidays for everything, you know, National Eat Your Favorite Vegetable Day. So what is your favorite vegetable?
My favorite vegetable right now is the asparagus growing in my garden. I go out and just pick it and eat it, and it's so delicious.
Oh, that sounds very good. Well, thanks, Anne, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 451 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy, and we have been discussing her book review of the new book from Beth Allison Barr called Becoming the Pastor's Wife, How Marriage Replaced Ordination as a Woman's Path to Ministry. Anne has written a review of this book, and her review is called Beth Allison Barr, Becoming the Leader She Knew She Could Be. And you can read it for free at equip.org. That's equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.